The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 4, Chapter 23. Down the slope of the sprawling tavern, at a table tucked behind a tree, Guy George picked at his own meal, going from elation to confusion at the arrival of the fourth man. Up the hill above him, amongst tourists eating their mussels and musing about the Acropolis, sat the final three faces on his target package, all together. Absolute proof he was correct about the conspiracy of his brother's death, and justification for the killing he'd done in Key West. He'd learned the location of just one face from the target package, Haider El Atia, and had to apply significant pressure to the man in the Key West restroom to get it. It hadn't been easy, and he hated himself for the action, both because of what he'd done and the fact that a small part of him enjoyed it. He'd seen enough horrific debasement of humanity in the search for truth during combat to know what he did had the chance of being nothing but sadistic satisfaction, the man telling him whatever he thought would stop the pain. The carnage he'd inflicted still ripped through his psyche, a permanent scar. He wasn't a pipe swinger like the men in foreign countries he'd seen use the techniques. Once, now long past, he'd been the soldier who broke up such things, prevented his cause from being tainted with the very awful the enemy used. Now, he was that enemy. When the man's essence had fled his carcass, a part of Guy's mind knew he'd crossed over, stepping past an invisible line that separated the righteous from the despicable. He'd shoved that part to the rear, listening to his brother's Pandora station and telling himself he was in the right, but deep down, not believing it. Seeing the men at the table above him brought vindication, a half step to redemption. He'd considered walking away right then, taking his digital photos and voice recordings with him. He could provide that to the task force and turn them loose. But he knew he wouldn't. He'd have to admit to killing the man in Key West, and that without sanction was murder. Regardless, he was sure the task force would not respond. Policy trumped blood. He'd already witnessed that, and he would never be forgiven. He was, to use a phrase, a dead man walking, and he was comfortable with the thought. His brother deserved what he could do, and his sacrifice would be worth it. But not before he killed the three at the table. He'd watched one of the men leave, then checked the level of his homemade audio capture device, using an Android app and a directional microphone plugged into the micro USB port of his phone, and saw that the noise pickup wasn't nearly as strong as he'd wanted. When he'd returned his eyes to the table, he'd seen the fourth man arrive, a man he knew as Nikos, which was significant trouble. In Key West, Guy had gleaned the one anchor point he needed, the Athenaeum Intercontinental Hotel in Athens, and had immediately flown to Greece, successfully testing his new identity and credit cards. Before beginning surveillance on the hotel, he needed two things: technical equipment and weapons. The tech stuff he managed to build off the shelf from a trip to a hobby store, a security boutique, and an electronics shop. It wasn't task force sleek, but he'd managed to develop a crude beacon, surreptitious camera, a beam-focused digital recorder, and various cell phone exploit tools. None of the devices were as powerful or compact as the state-of-the-art he could have drawn from the task force, but they'd get the job done, as the commercial sector grew ever closer to the surveillance world that was once an elite domain held by governments. The weapons, on the other hand, were a whole different kettle of fish. No way could he buy guns on the open market. He'd had to turn to a different source and risk exposure by doing so. He'd called a CIA case officer he knew was working in Greece. She was an old girlfriend of his roommate, Decoy, and she'd kept in touch with him after Decoy's death. calling him for dinner whenever they were both in D.C. She still didn't know whom he worked for, only that it was beyond her classification level. But in her world, she knew better than to ask. What really mattered was that she was now posted to the U.S. Embassy in Athens, and she trusted him, something he intended to leverage. As much as the Congressional Intelligence Committees wanted the CIA to deal solely with upstanding individuals, the work of intelligence necessitated stepping into the cesspool of humanity from time to time. And while the portfolio of the Athens station would include terrorism, it was focused more intently on the internal struggles of Greece, the Euro crisis, political strife, and yes, organized crime. They'd had lunch, him hinting he was operational and her beating around the bush about her own work. Eventually, he'd ask the favor, and using contacts she had, believing he was doing good for the United States, she'd set up a meeting with Nikos later that first night. After a myriad of security precautions, both on his part and Nikos's, he'd paid hard cash for a beat-up 6P9 pistol, a Russian weapon based on the Makarov, with an integral suppressor that could be broken down for travel, and a box of 9x18 ammunition. It was enough to get him through the mission, but he wasn't sure about the function of either. The weapon, old and worn, like bluing rubbed clean in several spots, and the cardboard box housing the ammunition looking like it had been moved from location to location for years without use. After the transfer, they had conducted their security dance and had parted ways, and he'd never expected to see Nikos again. But now he was here, meeting Guy's targets, which, from what he'd seen at last night's meeting, meant Nikos had put the entire restaurant under surveillance at least an hour before. There was no way he didn't know Guy was here. The only question was whether he thought Guy was a danger. Guy knew the answer to that. Coincidence was a luxury neither believed in. If the roles were reversed, Guy would assume he was a threat, and would have actively prepared to neutralize that threat. The biggest concern now was remaining anonymous from the other three men at the table. Guy had no idea why Nikos had arrived, and really didn't care. Nikos didn't know his name, but he did know what Guy looked like. Before Nikos could point him out or do something else to expose him, he rose, shoving his equipment into a fanny pack, throwing way more euros on the table than necessary. He slipped to the left, getting behind a tree and surveying quickly, regretting not bringing the pistol with him. He'd bought it purely for offensive action, and never thought he'd become the hunted. Behind him was a cut stone staircase leading sharply down the hill, the drop to the steps about 15 feet. To his front was the regular exit of the restaurant, leading straight by the target's table. Staircase it is. He swiftly turned, strode to the stone wall preventing drunkards from falling, and flipped over the side. He hung for a brief second, hearing a gasp from two pedestrians, then dropped. He hammered the ground hard, 1 foot high, one low, rolling on his ankle. He glanced up and saw a couple, the woman with her mouth covered, and ignored them both. He skipped down the steps two at a time, seeing the flow of pedestrians on the street below. Plaka, he knew, was an ancient neighborhood devoid of vehicles, made of twisting streets, tourist shops, and claustrophobic alleys. The only thing that penetrated the pedestrian throngs were mini bikes and mopeds. He had to get to a taxi, and he needed to get out of Plaka to do so. He glanced up the stairwell and saw two men appear, both with black leather jackets and beards. Not tourists. They began to follow. Because of the way his own meeting had been arranged, Nikos had to assume he was official U.S. government. But Guy had no idea how much weight that would carry. He hit the road below and turned right, toward Syntagma Square and the coughing, congested streets of Athens. Chapter 24. Guy glanced back and saw the two rushing down the stairs, the shallow glow of the mercury lamps making them seem simian, their glide anything but innocent. He darted into the crowd on the street, putting innocence in between him and his predators. Walking quickly, he went through his options and decided that getting to Syntagma Square was his best alternative. They were pipe swingers, no doubt, but they weren't official muscle. They had to worry about the authorities just as he did, and wouldn't attempt to harm him outright in the crowds. If he stuck to the main thoroughfares and stayed ahead of them, before they could present a threat, he could get out. He wound down the hill, skipping past bars and restaurants, losing altitude and gaining confidence. He reached a T-intersection, momentarily lost, but knowing that downhill was safety. To his left, he saw two policemen on BMW motorcycles, sitting on their saddles and smoking cigarettes. The deserted cobblestone road looking like it had been built by Socrates. Just beyond them was an alley between apartments that went sharply downhill. Perfect. They wouldn't do anything in the presence of the police, and might decide not even to follow him down the alley. He drew abreast, and one policeman sat upright. He felt a stab of adrenaline, but kept his pace. The other turned towards him, talking into a radio. The first drew his weapon and shouted in Greek. Jesus, they co-opted the police? How did they manage that? He took off at a dead sprint, hearing the crack of a round just as he hit the narrow defilade leading downhill. He heard the motorcycles rev and knew he was in trouble. Not only from the motorcycles, but from the radios the policemen held and their knowledge of the terrain, and the fact that someone had called them to begin with. He ran down the hill through the flickering moonlight and sparse vapor bulbs, realizing he'd channelized himself. He saw a splash of light on the cobblestones in front of him, his shadow in the middle, and knew the bikes were now behind him. He started looking for something to stop them. He saw nothing. He reached another street and went right, running up the asphalt until another alley opened on the left, going straight downhill almost as steep as a staircase. He could see the lights of the main shopping area below and knew he was close to the endless traffic and taxicabs, close to freedom. He bounded down the narrow lane, moving so quickly that he could barely maintain his balance, seeing the flat ground of a street below, a market full of pedestrians beyond. He heard the motorcycles behind him, their headlights bouncing over him, and doubled his pace. He was within 30 meters of breaking into the crowds when three men appeared out of the moonlight, running up the alley straight at him. Damn radios! Nothing remained but to fight. They came at him as a pack, intent on preventing him from reaching the safety of the street, each dependent on the courage of the man to his left or right. Guy had no such crutch. The first reached him and swung a section of bicycle chain at his head. Guy caught the movement and ducked under, looping his arm over the man's elbow and torquing his right leg behind the man's knee. He swept his leg back and slammed him into the ground with his shoulder, hard enough to cause a dull thump from the skull. Not even registering the victory, he whipped backwards with his left leg, catching the next assailant in the gut as he continued forward. Guy heard the air leave the man's lungs as he turned to the final target, moving too slow. The attacker swung a wicked fish priest, the head encased in metal, hammering him in the shoulder. The steel hit the brachial nerve near his collarbone, rendering his left side momentarily useless. Guy dropped to his knees, a panic for survival flooding him as the second attacker recovered from the kick. The men leapt at him. Guy, seeing both flash in a strobe effect of the bouncing headlights from the following bikes, like something from a 70s disco. The man with the club swung, and Guy rolled to the right, putting his back to the rough-hewn stone of the alley and hearing the metal strike rock, casting sparks. He protected his left and lashed out with his right, throwing a cross with his full weight behind it. The man's head whipped sideways, slamming into the rock wall. He crumpled to the ground as the final man approached. Guy saw the motorcycles gingerly bouncing down the narrow lane, getting closer, the lights bobbing like they were on stalks. He said, "I got no beef with you. Let me go. Tell Nikos this is a mistake." The man drew up and Guy saw his size for the first time. Easily over 6 feet, with a wide girth and a bearded, acne-scarred face. In broken English, he pointed at the man with the fractured skull and said, "You missed that chance." Hands to his front, the motorcycle still approaching, Guy's face curled into a death mask. "I don't have time for this shit. Bring it, you fuck." The man did, and in the instant before he died, realized that size alone had nothing to do with the fight. He swung a bar fight roundhouse, and Guy ducked under, pounding the right kidney with two deep strikes as he rotated behind. The man screamed, and Guy grabbed his hair, jerking him off balance. The target flailed his arms and tumbled backwards like a felled tree. Guy dropped to a knee, controlling the head as the body fell. The target's neck landing just above Guy's kneecap. There was a crack, and the man was dead, his own weight doing the damage. Guy let the man's head roll off his knee just as the first motorcycle reached him. The officer shouting from his bike, but unable to engage with his weapon without losing control. Guy leapt down the alley, straight into the flea markets surrounding Acropolis Park. Ignoring the stares from the myriad of tourists, he kept running until his lungs felt on fire, trying to remember the map he'd studied earlier, trying to remember where Syntagma Square was now that he was on level ground and free. He stayed near Acropolis Park, cutting through musicians playing for Euros and couples looking for romance, finally hitting the iron fence surrounding the Acropolis itself. The sight brought him renewed courage, as he knew there were taxis at the entrance. He saw the Acropolis Museum and realized he was close, just a couple hundred meters to freedom. He cut into a path in the trees and picked up the pace, the fence to his right and the pedestrian street to his left. Ahead, he saw the circle for the entrance, people still milling about even at this hour. He saw the line of taxis and darted out of the trees just as two motorcycles hit the circle from the city side, tires squealing as they hammered the brakes. They were followed by two more from his rear, the original hunters hitting him with their lights. He heard the shouts, the ones from the rear redirecting the new pair to his presence. With no other alternative, he turned into the park, running blindly, desperate to separate himself from the advantage of their motorcycles. He heard the rev of engines behind him and felt the fear. The park was wide open, threaded with roads, and it was empty. He knew eventually he'd hit the same 8-foot iron fence and wouldn't be able to get over it before they hit him. Even if he did, he would be in the Acropolis. He would be nothing more than a corralled animal, lashing out until he felt the spear. He ran on, the motorcycle's lights bouncing around him, the panic building. To his front, a hill of granite appeared, a giant, imposing knoll of stone with an iron staircase, and some plaque that he wouldn't read, even if he could in the dark. All he knew was that it was a break from the motorcycles. He leapt to the stairs just as the motorcycles reached him, dropping their bikes and giving chase on foot. He sprinted up, finding the crest and running to the far side, the men no more than 10 seconds behind him. He reached a cliff, the grassy earth 50 feet below. He cursed and did a slow turn, searching for options. There were none. He looked across the cliff and saw a park below, full of archaeological treasures, and recognized the Agora, Athens' ancient city center. On the far side was a cut for a metro train, a slice in the earth, and beyond was a street full of vendors. Escape. He heard the men scrambling up the rock face and decided. He'd either die from the drop or get away. He lowered himself flat and slid off the side, seeking footing way too fast for safety. He used roots and outcroppings to make it 15 feet down before his luck ran out. He felt the slide and tried to stop, but it did no good. He saw the police above him, shining lights in his eyes and shouting, and he screamed, falling into the void. He hit the ground hard, bouncing once, then rolled down the slope, coming to a stop in a field of grass. He lay for a moment, unsure if he was broken, the lights of the police far above. He rose up, the adrenaline rocking his body, and found he was stable. Beat to hell, but no permanent damage. He took off through the field, the glow of flashlights growing fainter behind him. The police nowhere near as insane as to try to follow. He came to the cut for the train tracks and leapt down, scrambling up the other side and reaching the pedestrian walkway, seeing tourists drinking beer in outdoor cafes. He climbed the fence, ignoring the shouts and iPhones pointed at him as he came over. He took the first street he could find, weaving deeper into the heart of the tourist trap markets and restaurants, looking for a place to stop, to assess what had happened. The man Nikos belonged to the Greek mafia, and they were known as the Godfathers of the Night because of their stranglehold on nightclubs in Athens. So any stop in such a place was basically suicide. But he needed to get off the street, to quit running once he had his break in contact. With the advantage of radios, moving now was the killer. He needed to hide until they grew tired of looking. He hit a small alley, busting through the tattoo parlors and teenagers, and saw a sign ahead. Salvation. It read, James Joyce Irish Pub, a place he could sit forever, and one definitely outside the neon and black lights of mafia-controlled nightclubs. He slid inside, pushing through the crowd of expats, and taking a seat at the very back, his eye to the door. A waitress came over, and with a wonderfully safe Irish accent said, "Poor thing, you looked tuckered." Guy gave her a crooked grin and said, "Yeah, sightseeing's a bitch. Can I get a Guinness?" She left, and he rapidly assessed what he knew. Trained to thrive in chaos, the last few minutes of adrenaline faded like tide from a beach, no longer worthy of reflection. He'd made some significant enemies inside Athens, but he still had a mission. He withdrew his recording device and put one earbud in, listening to the conversation before Nikos had arrived. He could make out little, the device nowhere near good enough to penetrate the wind and ambient noise of the other patrons. He strained to understand the mumbling about yachts, keys, and meetings, none of which did any good to focus his efforts. But he did hear one thing: Heraklion, Crete. Chapter 25. Secretary of State Jonathan Billings entered his hard car, still inside the U.S. Embassy compound in Athens. His six-man detail from the Bureau of Diplomatic Security doing a final check before the two-way vehicle convoy rolled back to the hotel. He'd had trouble staying focused on the endless briefings, but gave the ambassador his praise and well wishes on the progress made on various fronts. Now, preparing to leave, he was running through his head the excuses he'd need to ditch his security detail. He didn't really think he needed them, but then again, someone had launched a rocket-propelled grenade at the front of the embassy here in 2007. Maybe ditching them wasn't the best choice, but he had to for his next meeting. Because no matter what those asshole hawks in the Oversight Council thought, he was going to warn Haider al-Attiyah that a lunatic was after him. 3 days ago, he'd been roundly shut down with his accusations that the task force was operating unilaterally inside the United States, assassinating Qatari citizens based on nothing but a bloodied target package from Afghanistan. One day later, Kurt had called an emergency meeting, something that rarely occurred, which caused all 13 members to show. He'd stated that they had no proof of task force involvement in Key West, but that he was missing a task force member. A man had basically gone AWOL. And conveniently, Billings thought, it was the brother of the soldier killed in Afghanistan. Billings knew the whole damn thing was nothing but a show designed to cover up extra-legal task force operations. If there even was such a thing, given their extra-legal existence to begin with, and had demanded that the family be informed. Kurt had balked, saying he had no proof and was taking steps to confirm or deny the situation. Billings had said, "What does that mean, taking steps? Either the guy's on the loose or he's not. I've detailed Pike Logan to find him, to bring him in. My bet is he's on a bender somewhere in the United States. He lost Decoy, then his brother, and it took a toll. I saw it, but didn't think he wouldn't go to the funeral. Pike will find him."
"Pike? Are you serious? You think he'll bring him in?"
"Far from it. If anything, that psycho will give him pointers." President Warren interceded at that point, saying, "Calm down, John. Kurt's doing what he can, and airing your personal grievances about individual task force members isn't helping. Kurt informs us of the status, but the tactical decisions are his." The Secretary of Defense got in. "And he did save the damn Pope last year. Give him a break." Billings said, "Okay, fine. But what about the Qatari guys? What about Haider al-Attiyah?" President Warren said, "What about them?" "They need to be warned." He turned to Kerry Bostwick, the director of the CIA, and said, "Don't you have a protocol for sources or assets when you come across a death threat? Don't you have to warn them?" Kerry shifted in his chair, clearly uncomfortable with the direction the conversation had taken.
"This isn't the CIA. This is the task force. And we have the means to control the outcome."
Billings looked at the president and said, "That's not what I asked."
"Sir?"
President Warren said, "Kerry, what's the protocol?" Kerry placed his elbows on the table and rubbed his hands together, then said,
"Okay, yes, if we come across a threat to a source, regardless of the source's orientation or cooperation, we warn them. But that's not this."
Billings said,
"That's exactly this. The only difference is that it's not threat stream reporting. It's one of our own guys."
Kurt interjected, "We don't know that. Give Pike a chance." Billings cut him off.
"Bullshit, we don't know. We might not wish to know, but this is an unmitigated disaster. Haider is the one helping me with that thing in Afghanistan. Haider's the member of the QIA that's willing to invest in Greece. We lose him at our own hands, and it will be the worst foreign policy disaster in recent memory. And make no mistake, there have been some disasters."
President Warren said, "No warning. We handle this on our own. Let the task force work it."
"Sir, I think we need to look at this holistically. The task force has gone rogue. We are on the verge of bringing down this whole administration."
He paused and went from man to man, looking every member of the Oversight Council in the eye.
"Everyone in this room is looking at a jail cell. That's a given. But we still have our duty to honor what we know to those threatened. It's unconscionable to not do so. At least let him prepare, increase his own security."
And for the first time, the words were said aloud, thrown into the daylight from the dark. The true dilemma tossed into the room. They had created a unique organization to resolve imminent threats, but in so doing, they had thrown out what made the United States what it was. Thrown out the oversight and the second guessing. thrown out transparency and democracy for the greater good. It had sounded responsible after 9/11, given the threat, something that was needed, even if the U.S. Constitution wouldn't allow it. The task force had worked like a well-oiled machine for years, proving its worth, eliminating one threat after another. A benign beast growing in strength, it had always done what was asked by the council. But now, it was off the rails, the beast looking for blood outside of the masters. A man recruited, trained, and equipped for missions at the national level. Someone told repeatedly to ignore the laws of the land for the greater good, was now doing exactly what he'd been taught. Every person in the room was under the knife. President Warren said, "Kurt, thoughts?"
"Give Pike a chance. He'll bring him in. There's no reason to panic here."
Billings said,
"I'm not panicking. I'm being prudent. Maybe we should also alert the FBI, get him in the system, use the CIA or whatever else we can do to get his name out there."
Kurt glared and said,
"We can't do that without the very compromise you fear. Anyway, I don't need someone else to put down a horse that belongs to me."
Billings rolled his eyes and said,
"Sir? Really? Now we're worried about egos?"
Warren said, "Kurt's right. No reason for extreme measures. No warning. Let it run its course." Billings bit his lip, but knew what he was going to do. He had a conscience, unlike the men around the table. Now, driving out of the embassy compound in Greece, he was about to step across the line, put his own conscience in front of his obligations. He drew strength from the example of Edward Snowden, another man who had bucked what the traditional establishment had said was right. He owed it to himself to do the same. The small motorcade left the main road and rounded the snake-like streets, going through alleys and neighborhoods to the Athenaeum Intercontinental. The hotel was not, to put it mildly, in the best part of town, and he would have stayed at his habitual haunt of the Hotel Grand Britannia, where everyone who was anyone stayed. But Hyder was booked at the Intercontinental, and doing a meeting inside the hotel was the only way to avoid his security detail following him like a piece of gum picked up by his shoe. They rounded the corner, and Billings saw the internal hotel security, aware of his presence and hoping to make a permanent impression. The two cars entered the small drive, and he waited, one man exiting and opening his door, the rest fanning out. He shook the hand of the poor bellman, the guy terrified of screwing up.
"Thank you, thank you."
They entered the expansive lobby, him in a bubble of security, his executive assistant one step behind, and everyone else staring at who had arrived. The hotel staff blocked off the elevator access, allowing him to ride alone, his detail talking amongst themselves in their radios.
Ridiculous.
He hated the security detail. It was exactly what wasn't needed as a diplomat. How could he encourage democracy and human rights when armed thugs surrounded him everywhere he went? The elevator opened and his security entered first, pushing the button to his floor. Billings sank against the railing, running through what he would say to Hyder. The elevator stopped and his assistant said, "Sir, did you want to go over the minutes for tomorrow's meeting now?"
"No, Leslie, we can do that later. Jet lag's hitting me. I'll call you for dinner."
She smiled and went the opposite way than him down the hall. No security with her. Minutes later, he was at his suite, the room cleared by his detail. He went to his computer, pretending to work, giving them time to exit. After the door had been closed for a minute or two, he dialed his phone and received a room number. He packed up his laptop and exited. The lone security man outside his door was startled, saying,
"Sir, I thought you were in for the afternoon."
He raised his wrist to talk into the radio, and Billings said,
"I am, I am. I'm just headed to the executive lounge to get a bottle of water."
"Sir, I can get that for you.
I want to get it myself, Billings snapped. Stay here. I'll be fine. I don't need a guard dog to go to the damn lounge.
The man shuffled his feet, but did as he was told. Billings turned without another word and went to the elevators. He rode down 2 floors, then exited. He found the room number and softly knocked. A man he didn't recognize opened the door, dressed smartly in a pinstriped suit, with a well-groomed beard shaved close to his face. Billings thought he was nothing but a manservant for Hyder, one of the many anyone important from Cotter would use, and came close to barging in, as he was accustomed in his position. But the man looked him full in the eye, and he saw a little crazy leaking out. He waited outside. The man said, "Sir, I am Khalid. Hyder is waiting in the other room."
Chapter 26.
Billings traveled through the suite to the large bedroom, seeing Hyder on the balcony outside drinking tea. He stood, a large smile on his face, embracing Billings with a traditional touching of cheeks. After greetings, Billings glanced at Khalid, and Hyder said,
"Khalid, could you check my computer for emails, please?"
Khalid nodded and left them alone. Hyder poured Billings tea, and they made small talk for a few minutes. Eventually, they transitioned to Greece, discussing Qatari investment in a natural gas-fired power plant and other infusions of much-needed capital. Billings searched for an entrance and finally received it when Hyder said,
"With the turmoil in the world, Carter feels it irresponsible to not invest in Greece. It's sound policy."
He smiled and said,
"We don't need one more state falling into chaos."
Billings nodded and said, "That's wise. And another reason I believe Carter can help with other conflicts. Remember the peace initiative I spoke of, between the Taliban and the Afghanistan government?"
Acting disinterested, Hyder said,
"Yes, I do. I must say that it is out of my portfolio."
But when I brought it up, he raised a hand and said,
"Discreetly, I assure you. My government was astounded that such a thing could be happening behind its back."
Billings said, "There's no great mystery, it's just the way of diplomacy. You remember the talks held in Norway between the High Peace Council and several Taliban officials from the office in Doha?"
"Yes, of course. They kept us informed of all of that, but it was unofficial. Just some women from Afghanistan demanding rights. Nothing came of it."
"Well, partially correct. What came of it was an overture from the HPC. They want to conduct serious talks, using the nothing meetings as cover for the real ones. Too much pressure is put on the talks when they're officially announced. Too much is expected, forcing both sides to utter stupid things, preventing the very talks they want. This way, both can come secretly. Nobody's even looking at Norway."
Hyder nodded, thinking. He said,
"So a talk within a talk, without any official announcement, that might actually do some good."
Billings smiled and said, "I'm glad you feel that way, because the United States recognizes the power Cotter holds, and we'd like you to be the emissary, unofficially. We can't have anyone known in the Qatari government show up in Oslo. It would defeat the entire purpose. Do you think you could do such a thing? Act as the go-between?"
Hyder said, "I would be honored, and I thank you for the trust. When will this occur, so I may ensure my availability?"
"I don't know yet. The details are still being worked out, but the initial meeting will be soon. Days, not weeks. Understand, the Taliban office in Doha knows nothing, and it must remain that way for security purposes."
Hyder said, "Don't worry. If anyone understands security and secrecy, It's the Qatar Investment Authority.
Whenever we try to invest overseas, if it becomes public knowledge, you Westerners, how do you say, come out of the woods to stop it?
Billings laughed and said, I think you mean come out of the woodwork, but I believe you.
He paused on the threshold, the moment of truth.
Hyder said, what is it?
Speaking of security, there's something else I must tell you. I've learned through our intelligence agencies that there may be a threat against you.
His cup halfway to his lips, Hyder paused, then said,
a threat from your intelligence agency?
Billings had decided that conveying the danger was good enough. In no way did he want to implicate himself or cause damage to all that he was doing by exposing the reality.
He said, no, no, not from us. We just heard about it. We don't know who it is, but it came out of Afghanistan, and your name was mentioned. Something ridiculous about an operation you supposedly conducted. It could be nothing but coincidence. A mistaken name or something else, but you should take precautions. Please, I'm breaking protocol for even telling you. But I felt it was necessary.
Hyder said, I appreciate the trust. Hyder watched the door close, Billings heading back to his room.
Khalid said, well?
We're in, but there is a significant issue.
What?
Hyder paused, not wanting another experience like he'd had last night. He'd finally gathered the courage to tell Khalid about the death of his brother. And as expected, Khalid was distraught, wanting to fly to the United States and kill someone just to relieve the pain. He'd eventually calmed down, but now walked about with a permanent scowl, looking for a slight in anything the hotel staff did.
Hyder made his decision.
Billings says there is a threat against me. He stated he didn't know from where, but it had to do with Afghanistan.
Khalid said, the man last night.
Yes, Secretary Billings is lying. He knows exactly who it is, but is playing like a spy. He's too worried about our partnership to let it go, but too stupid to realize I can see through him. It was the American from the restaurant, and apparently he's hunting me.
Khalid said, does this have anything to do with Ahmed?
Hyder hadn't considered that. He thought about it, then said,
I don't see how. That was in Key West, Florida. The American is here, in Greece.
Maybe it's not just a single American. How well do you trust Secretary Billings?
Enough. The logic makes no sense. If Billings had anything to do with it, why on earth tell me? No, he knows what it is, and he's afraid of anything happening to me because it will hurt him. It's no different than the tribal politics in Qatar.
Khalid nodded and said,
what do you want to do? You want me to interdict him?
Secretary Billings? No, no. That's the last thing I want. Call Nikos. He found the man once. He can do so again. We will fight fire with fire.
Chapter 27. I sat back in disgust. Are you telling me the greatest hackers in the United States inventory can't get me a lead on Guy George? That he's dropped off the face of the earth without a trace? My favorite computer geek, Bartholomew Creedwater, Creed in Task Force parlance, said, Pike, I can't see into the guy's head. As much as you think I'm God, I can't penetrate the time-space continuum. I need a handle. He glanced at Jennifer, making sure she knew that he was on his game, and it wasn't his fault. Creed was currently detailed to some computer operation involving North Korea, but when I'd been given this mission, I'd demanded his release and Kurt had agreed. He was the best we had, and not averse to bending the rules, something I was sure I'd need on this shitty assignment. But he also had an unremitting crush on Jennifer, which annoyed the hell out of me. She treated him like a little brother, and he responded to the attention. A couple of years ago, he'd seen her do some pretty incredible commando stuff on a mission in Colorado, and he'd fallen head over heels for her, thinking he was looking at the incarnation of the Black Widow from an Avengers movie. It was a little pathetic. But when I'd made a joke about it to Jennifer, she'd taken a front, calling me a bully. So now I had to endure his clumsy attempts at getting into her pants if I wanted his help. Okay, that's not entirely true. I was willing to dangle Jennifer to get what I wanted. It's called leadership. I said, come on. We own every bit of data on the guy. Surely you can find something. He's had to use a credit card, cell phone, bank account, or something. Pike. He's not using anything associated with his identity. Outside of that cash withdrawal over a week ago, he's done nothing. He's a ghost. How in the hell do you guys manage to find terrorists with nothing but a name, but can't find this guy when we have his biometric data and every detail of his life? Creed looked at me and said, he's well trained. He knows exactly what we're looking for. Which scared the hell out of me, because it told me he wasn't just on a bender somewhere. If he had gone this far to hide his tracks, he was doing something bad, stepping into the abyss. Once that path was crossed, it was very, very hard to come back. I knew because I'd been there, and now I was supposed to put him down. I kept thinking of that Clint Eastwood movie from the 90s, In the Line of Fire, where the ex-CIA man and would-be assassin of the president says, what you didn't see, Frank, what you couldn't possibly know, is they sent my best friend, my comrade in arms, to my home to kill me. I'd always wondered who the real bad guy was in that movie, if maybe the assassin hadn't been justified. Now I was going to find out the hard way. I said, okay, okay. Then we go to square one. Guy's smart, I get that. Let's use it against him. He's got to operate, and we know he's not using Task Force kit, so what is he using? He's going to have a drop phone, but it'll be a smartphone. He's going to use apps. He's going to leverage COT stuff, and we can track that. Creed sank back, not wanting to give his answer, but he did. Pike, you're right. With the spyware embedded in most apps, sending data to the host, we could find his location, but even with commercial stuff off the shelf, we have to know the name he's using to sign in. We can't hack an account without it. I can't just dig into Apple and find a ghost. I have to know what I'm looking for. Or in reverse, we have to know his phone IMEI so we could crack the app. But if we had that, we wouldn't need the app. I bunched my fists and Jennifer stepped in saying, what about Task Force apps? Has anyone downloaded those in the last few days? The Task Force had its own cloud with a bunch of apps that could be downloaded in a pinch if an operator had lost some Task Force kit and was forced to use an in extremis capability. They were definitely more robust than anything on the civilian market, but he hadn't used any of them. It was just one more backup to the backup in the Task Force arsenal, and I'd already checked on their use. No, nothing downloaded in the last few days, but he knows we can track that stuff. All of them have malware embedded, waiting to be initiated in case of loss on an operation. He wouldn't want the tether. Jennifer nodded and kept at it. Travel history? If he goes overseas, he's got to use a passport, and that will be tied biometrically. Glad for the breakaway from tech stuff, Creed said he hasn't left the United States, at least not with his passport. And we know he hasn't used any aliases from the task force. They're all accounted for. Jennifer looked at me and said, that's something. At least we know he's in the United States. Creed beamed at the supposed compliment from his statement. I glared at him and said, bullshit, we know nothing. I'm telling you, this target is the worst we've ever seen. He's smart and he's skilled. An absence of data is proof of nothing. Creed, build me a list of off-the-shelf spy apps for both Android and Apple. Not the stupid baby cam crap, the good stuff. That's what he's going to use. Jennifer said, Pike, let's not make this into something it's not. He's just an operator. He's not Creed. Creed looked at her like a high schooler gazing at a woman in a cosplay costume who deigned to say hello, completely undone by the compliment. I straightened up from staring at the computer and said, "Both of you listen to me. Because it needs to be said, Guy George is every bit as good as me. And if he's truly on the hunt, he's going to figure out how to do it. Just like I would. Don't underestimate him, especially his capacity for violence." Jennifer looked unconvinced. I said, "What did you think when we first met?" Trying to deflate the atmosphere, she said, "I thought you were a drunk." I locked eyes with her and said, "What did you think in Guatemala when the blood began to flow?" She got the point. I'd slaughtered many men to keep her alive, and I was sliding into the abyss even as I did it. Jennifer was the one who'd saved me from falling in completely. She kept her eyes on mine, then slowly said, "I thought you were death, but you were killing for a reason." I nodded and said, "Yes, but he thinks he's killing for a reason. That's what we're stopping, and I want to do it before Guy crosses a line he can't come back from." Guy had come in brash and strong to the Special Mission Unit, with a background from both the Ranger Battalions and Special Forces, walking up the military ladder of every unit worth a damn. He was one of those guys that just knew he was right, and always fighting decisions because he had a better idea. You said left, he said right. If you had said right, he'd have said left. But he backed up the bravado with brains, strength, and skill. Not unlike me, before I knew better. I'd recruited him to the task force, knowing Kurt would never put him on my team because we were too much alike. I knew he'd feel that much unbridled arrogance on a team could cause a catastrophic event. So my team got Decoy, and Guy had gone to Johnny's team. In the end, it had been the right choice, as both teams flourished. To me, the obvious decision was Johnny tracking down his own man, but Kurt hadn't seen it that way. The excuse was that Johnny's team was already deployed, and pulling them back would endanger ongoing operations, but I knew better. Johnny was too close to Guy, and Kurt feared his emotions would prevent him from doing what was necessary. Left unsaid was just what that might be. Kurt could give excuses, but I understood I was chosen because I had served with the target as well, but I wasn't close enough to be clouded. I told myself that, but I wondered if Kurt, having seen me at my worst, believed I was the only person capable of solving the problem because of my past. Like I had crossed a line once before, which I had, and because of it, I was capable of returning there if he asked for it. It was a thing I didn't want to even think about, but it hovered in the room like the stench of a dead animal. I wondered if Kurt thought I'd execute because I was the best at this and he trusted me, or because I had no soul. It hurt. Yes, I knew the target, but that only increased my fear. Guy George had been born fighting, a tow-headed rangy guy from a broken home in a small town in Texas. He had been raised on bull riding and beer drinking, not exactly what the task force was searching for when they wanted someone to blend in Amman Jordan, but then again, neither was I. We recruited for diversity, trying to find men who could swim amongst various populations without leaving a ripple, but skill outweighed any other consideration. I had seen him operate in hostile lands all over the globe, finding ways to get the mission done regardless of his race. He had proven to be a cunning predator, just like me. And now I was hunting him, possibly the only one in the room who knew the danger he truly represented. Chapter 28. I heard the door open behind me and saw Kurt enter, ripping down my little sign. He was followed by someone else. He held out the computer printout, which read, "Alex Station," saying, "I don't see the humor. No jokes on this one." Jennifer glared at me behind his back. When I'd hung the sign, she'd told me it was in poor taste, and as usual, she was right. We'd been given our own top-secret little office to work our wonders searching for Guy, and I thought it had needed a name in case anyone came looking. Alex Station was the code name for the CIA's counter-terrorist cell that tracked Osama bin Laden before 9/11. Given our mission, I thought it was funny. Sheepishly, I took the paper and said, "Got it, sir." He said, "Where do we stand?" Well, in the confirm or deny his location department, We've done a lot of denying, but very little confirming. He hasn't been to either his home of record in Montana or his condo in D.C., and hasn't used anything associated with his identity. No checks, credit cards, easy pass, toll use, car rentals, plane tickets, nothing. And we're sure he hasn't stolen one of his alias documentation packages? Yep, positive. He's moving, but we don't know how or where. He's just disappeared. The man behind him stepped out. When Kurt had entered, I'd naturally thought it was George Wolfe, his deputy, and did a double take when I saw who it was. Nicholas Seacrest, looking lost and hesitant to even be in the room. I said, well, well, if it isn't Veep. He grinned half-heartedly at his call sign, letting Jennifer hug him and awkwardly kiss him on the cheek. He freed himself from her embrace and shuffled from foot to foot. I looked at Kurt and said, so he's a go? You're giving me permission to take him and show him the ropes? Kurt said, that'll depend on whether you have any reason to use him or not. I'd returned to D.C. about 6 hours after Jennifer's little award ceremony. Kurt had told me about the death in Key West, and had then laid the bombshell that he wanted me to form up a cell and find Guy. He still didn't believe that Guy would perform an extrajudicial killing, but he was covering his bases. I could tell a part of him was scared, really scared. He told me whatever assets I wanted were mine, and I'd given him my requirements. He'd relented at Creed, but had balked at the mention of Veep. Nicholas Seacrest was a combat controller, Air Force Special Operations, and had been taken hostage and held for ransom by a terrorist group. My team had been the one that had rescued him, and then he'd been instrumental in helping us rescue another hostage that meant a great deal to both me and Kurt. He'd performed very well under pressure, both in captivity and out, and when it was over, I'd subtly recruited him for the task force, not saying anything to Kurt and never thinking he'd bite. He had, and the Oversight Council had gone ballistic, because he had a little bit of a pedigree. He was the vice president's son, which is why he was slapped with the call sign Veep. After a little wrangling, he was allowed into assessment and selection, which he passed with flying colors, something I'd never doubted, because I'm a scary judge of talent. Just ask Jennifer. He was now in the training pipeline, learning all sorts of Jason Bourne tradecraft to survive as an operator in the task force. It had been a little bit of an unspoken agreement that he was coming to my team when he finished his training, but because of this mission, I'd asked to pull him early. Kurt had drawn the line at that, or so I'd thought. A day ago, he'd said, no way. He's not even on probation status. He has to finish training first, then go through all the alias documentation procedures and still has to deploy for his check ride on an orientation mission before even walking across the hall to a team, 3 or 4 months easily. I said, sir, one of the reasons you gave me this was because Johnny was too close to Guy. That cuts both ways. He couldn't track Guy on the ground because Guy knows every one of his team members on site. The same goes for me. Kurt had said, don't build this up into an Omega mission. All I want you to do is talk to him. Bring him back to the task force. I get that, but I might have to track him to do it. Find him on the ground and determine his state of mind. We're not talking about a high school kid playing hooky. He failed to show up at his own brother's memorial. Something's not right and you know it. I'm not going to run up to him at a bar and slap him on the back the first chance I get. I want to observe him first, and I need a clean team to do that. He doesn't know Jennifer. He hasn't met her, has he? No. I've got both Brett and Jennifer who are clean, as far as I know. Knuckles is no good, but he'll help when I approach him. I want to go 2-on-1 for that. But I need at least one more. Nick is squeaky clean, and he's worked with me before. I don't want someone from another team that I don't know. Pike, I'm having a hard enough time just keeping him in training. The council only agreed to let him attend the course. They still haven't given permission for him to go operational. I'm taking it one step at a time, and broaching this now might mean he's never coming to your team. What's Hannister saying about it? Philip Hannister was the vice president and an oversight council member. While in the Air Force, Nicholas had taken his mother's maiden name of Seacrest as a security precaution. He's good from what I can see. He's not super comfortable with his son coming here, but it's no worse than he was when Guy was in white SOF to begin with. He's okay as a father. He's never fought what his son wanted. It's the professional connection that's got the council concerned. Go talk to Hannister, him and the president. You can get them alone and get concurrence. When you first gave me this mission, you talked about the changes coming to the task force because of the presidential election. Start planning for it. Hannister is running and very well might win. What better way to set the tone for the task force under the new administration than having the son of the president inside it? Kurt raised an eyebrow and said, I thought you hated the politics of the Oversight Council. Never want to get your hands dirty with the crap I have to deal with. The whole all I want to do is operate thing is bullshit, huh? I smiled and said, no, I do hate it. But that doesn't mean I don't understand it. All I want to do is operate. Chapter 29. Nick looked a little more relaxed after Jennifer pecked him on the cheek. I understood how he felt, given he was still in training. It didn't matter how big of a badass you thought you were. When you came into the task force for the first time, you couldn't help but feel a little inadequate, especially if the commander of the entire organization pulled you from training. Nick probably thought he was getting fired. I said, oh, I'll use him all right. It looks like the conversation with Pop went okay. Yeah, Kurt said. Let's just say the council is a little concerned about Guy. You know pigs have started flying when they take your advice. Tell me you've got something beyond knowing he's not in Montana, some magical pike thread. Not yet, but I will. He's not using any special tools, which means he's relegated to commercial stuff. Still pretty significant. And I've got Creed trying to locate what apps he'd use, what technology he'd focus on to track a guy. There are a ton of useless catch-my-wife-cheating apps, but there are a few that are pretty damn devious. And that's where he'll gravitate, that is, if he's really on the hunt. Kurt said, Pike, Johnny called today. His team deployed on schedule, but he's missing one piece of kit, a gremlin. He did a pre-deployment inventory and it was there. Now it's not. The gremlin was a small device the size of an iPad mini, with a folding antenna and a plastic case on the back the size of a cigarette pack. Its sole purpose was remotely slaving a cell phone for the introduction of malware. If you knew the IMSI or IMEI of a targeted phone, you could trick the phone into talking with the device, and it would implant any program you wanted, with certain caveats based on the cell network and security settings of the phone. It being missing wasn't a good sign. I said, hey, sir, let's not go on a witch hunt here. Maybe it's up in the team room. We can't assume that Guy took it. Deep inside, I didn't want to believe what Kurt was saying. I didn't want to face the reality. Kurt said, Pike, you remember what you were like back in the bad days after your family? Hearing an echo of what I'd said earlier, I caught Jennifer's eye and said, yes. Could you do this? Would you be capable? I said nothing for a moment. He said, Pike. I looked at him and said, yeah. Yeah, I could do it. If it meant finding the murderer of my family, I'd have done it without looking back. But Guy isn't me. This is a different situation. My family was killed in the United States, not on a combat patrol. And I was a little screwed up. This has nothing to do with me. Kurt took a breath, assimilating what I said, then dropped the hammer. It has everything to do with you. Sorry, but you set the precedent. President Warren is talking about shutting down the task force, saying that our operational parameters are so far outside the law, we've inculcated a bunch of pirates, men who don't know where the line is anymore. Because we removed the line for them. And you're case study number one. What the hell, seriously? I lost my way, but don't put this on me. My family was murdered in the United States. His was killed in combat. Guy is not my fault. Nobody's saying that. But they're looking at the comparison. At one time, you were the closest thing to bringing us down, and now you're the closest thing to preventing that. I sighed and said, "What do you want from me?" "I want him home. I want him back in the fold." I heard the words, but they didn't really express what he desired, what the end state could be. I said, "And if I can't do that? If I can't get him back in the fold, what do you want?" He dodged the question. "What do you have to work with?" I said, "Creed?" The computer geek turned around, looking scared, and said, "We don't really have anything. I'm collating everything he could use, but we don't have usernames or accounts. We're fishing." Nicholas Seacrest shuffled a bit, looking hesitant, then finally opened his mouth. "Maybe we're looking in the wrong place. Don't try to find specific surveillance apps. Look for apps everybody uses." I said, "Like what? Facebook, Instagram, that kind of thing. If he's using it mobile, we can get his location." He saw us staring at him like a church group hearing rap music. He said, "What? You guys don't use Instagram, Snapchat?" Nick was a full 10 years younger than anyone else on my team. I said, "No, we don't. And neither will you in about a month. If you think Guy George is posting on Instagram, you've proven me wrong in my choice of teammates. Welcome to the real clandestine world, Air Force." He sank back against a wall, wanting to crawl through it to the skull-crushing training he'd left, and Jennifer sidled up to me, pinching my arm, telling me without speaking I was being too harsh. She'd lived in the Task Force He-Man world, getting beat up just like I was doing to Nick, and she didn't like it. I glanced at her and she whispered, "Calm down, Commando. You might not be the smartest in the room." I gave her a small grin, pulling back a couple of gears, because she was the smartest person in the room. But I wasn't done with Nick. I said, okay, start over, Veep. He's not using social media, but he might be using something we can find. What else you got in your hipster toolkit?" Nick looked at me like I was just baiting him for another insult. I said, "Cat got your tongue? You pining away for Kylie? Wishing you could just curl up in bed with her and get away from the mean people?" Kylie was Kurt's niece, and the one I had been tracking to find when I rescued Nick, the one I'd really wanted to save. At the time, I could have given a shit about him, but he'd ended up being pretty solid under fire. And it turned out he cared about Kylie as much as I did. In a different way, of course. Nick scowled, his face going crimson. Jennifer hissed, "Do you think that's helping?" I said, "I want to know what Veep's got beyond just another face that Guy doesn't recognize. You have anything at all to contribute?" Yeah, I was being an ass, but it was for a reason. I wanted to determine if what I'd seen before was real. If this guy could take the pressure he was under and produce. Even if that production would be nothing more than snapping back at me, I needed to see if he had heart. I glanced at Jennifer, telling her to back off on supporting him, letting her know she wasn't doing him any favors. She got it. She'd been there before and understood. Nick glanced at Kurt, then said to me, "Sorry, Granddad. I didn't know I had to spell it out. He's got a digital trail just like you do. That didn't start with my generation. You ever bought anything on Amazon?" I nodded, telling him to continue. He gained courage, saying, "I promise he has a trail under his real name. And there will be a crossover with whatever name he's using now. Maybe he doesn't use social media, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, but he's using something. Uber, Spotify, something like that. He can stay away from what you're looking for, but he's using something you're not seeking, I promise." When I didn't respond, he rolled his eyes and said, "Jesus, I'm not saying he's blabbing on Yik Yak, but he's using something." I said, "What the hell is Yik Yak?" Before he could answer, Kurt snapped his fingers and said, "Wait a minute. He might have a point." He opened the door and snagged the first person he saw, saying, "Get me George Wolf right now." I said, "What do you have?" "Nothing yet, but maybe something. George sat with Guy after our meeting, and he said something about a playlist." George entered within seconds, saying, "What's up?" "I'm dealing with some serious blowback from the North Korea thing you handed me. Am I here to take Creed back? I could use him." Kurt said, "No such luck. You remember when you were talking to Guy George after our meeting? He had earbuds in and ignored you?" Wolf looked confused, saying, yeah. He was listening to a Pandora station his brother had created. Kurt said, his brother? He was listening on his brother's account? You sure about that? Yeah, I think so. He talked about how his brother had created it, and it was the only thing he had left from him. Why? I smiled at Nick and said, you'll do.
This ends Disc 4.